So welcome back as we continue with the Bhagavad Gita. Last week we did the first six chapters, an arduous undertaking, I know. This week we hope to move from chapter 7 through 12, but we should touch upon, slightly summarize anyway, what we've done to this point, what we've heard Krishna say. We've seen that Krishna is joined with Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Two armies poised to fight a war with Dharma as the real prize. It isn't that they're looking on the Pandava side simply to have a kingdom. They are looking to continue the reign of righteousness in India. Arjuna, which means silver or white, stands on this field in his chariot with Krishna as his charioteer, Krishna, which means black, dark. And the symbolism is something wonderful, because the chariot on which they stand symbolizes the very adhara of our being, our very vehicle, body, life, mind, and soul. Krishna, in a sense, represents the inmost soul, and the body, the chariot, the horses, the life impulse, Arjuna, the mind. So all of this is there in that one symbol, but for the white and black, the black and white. Krishna, who is going to reveal himself as the supreme being, the supreme person, is that blackness of the unmanifest, what we don't know, what we can't see with the light of common senses. Arjuna is that light which is manifest, which comes in a sense out of the darkness as a definition of light. So he is meant to be the perpetrator of great good on the field of battle. That field of battle is Dharmakshetra. It is the field of Dharma. It is Kurukshetra, the field of the Kurus. They all come from that Kuru tribe, the perhaps most ancient branch of the Aryan people. So there they stand, and Krishna says, behold this army arrayed in opposition to you, as if inviting Arjuna to see the spectacle of slaughter into which he is about to enter. So already, simply with that statement, Krishna has given us a hint that he is behind all of this. Beguilingly, he says, observe out here, Arjuna, what do you see? And Arjuna is immediately faint-hearted. The greatest warrior of the age throws down his bow, the bow with which he is promised conquest. He is not going to lose this fight. The gods have decided it in advance. Dharma will prevail. Just be the instrument, be God's hammer, as it were. But he throws it down and says, I'm going to turn away. I'm going to instead renounce the world. Krishna, tell me, I turn to you as my teacher, who has only been his friend to this point. What should I do? And Krishna says, pick up the bow and fight. And then begins to give him the basic of the Vedantic knowledge, which was common to all twice-born people at that time, that the soul cannot be slain. It does not die with the passing of the body. There is no sense in grief. For those who are immortal by nature, you cannot cut this soul, you cannot wet it. So, knowing that, pick up and fight, because your nature is not the nature of the sannyasi. You are not to renounce the world. You will be spoken of in vilifying terms if you flee the battlefield. They'll call you a coward. Nothing is worse for you than that. You must face it. But you must learn how to act correctly, how to do your works in the world without desire, without demand for the fruit. Arjuna, start with this. You do the work to which you have a right. Claim not the fruit. And he is not here. Krishna is quite plain. He is not here talking about what is considered good work in those days, which was that yoked to the sacrifice. He's not trying to put money into the pockets of the Brahmins who will perform the yajñas. No, he is taking the idea of work away from the Vedic sacrifice and expanding it. He keeps the idea that it is through sacrifice that the world is established. In his greater teaching, he reveals that he, Krishna, as the Lord of the universe, represented on earth in this form of Krishna, began all of this with sacrifice, sustains it with sacrifice, that every being, whether he knows it or not, is pouring works into this sacrificial fire, but do it with knowledge. Do it with increasing selflessness. Do it without reference to your own person. Simply do the work, recognizing that that does sustain the universe. And then you work in concert with me. Then you hold together the worlds. You hold together the people, loka sangraha. So Krishna has already taken us in a great progression beyond what was the typical teaching of the Veda, and is about to throw us into dimensions even beyond what the Upanishads offered, because he reveals that this idea of doing work for the good of all, yukta to the divine, in increasing harmony and knowledge, is what he used to teach, that he gave this original teaching to the sun, yes, the solar orb, and then it passed down through Manu and many, many in the long lineage which sustains humanity, so that this teaching should not ever perish, because it is how you work and live in the world. This is how you do it right. But Arjuna is a little confused, because you're Krishna and you're here on the battlefield, and yet you're telling me that you are the supreme. And he says, yes, that from age to age I am born to help sustain the Dharma, and this is just such a time. Why does he have to sustain the Dharma? Because the universe has a meaning. The universe has a purpose. And the divine's purpose is being worked out through all of these. And so again, Arjuna is enjoined to the battle. Fight. Pick it up. Be my comrade in battle. You be the occasion of the killing. You do not kill anything. We've already decided that. I am the supreme, have decided the fate of all these beings. And so, step back into the play. And let's bring ourselves to the seventh chapter. now and start tonight's study, having roughly summarized what we did last week. It's here in the seventh chapter, something important is about to be said. Krishna has told Arjuna about how to work and how to live in communion with the divine, but that divine has not been clearly defined. The idea that there are three gunas which are acting in nature has been posited. It is not identical to what would later be the Sankhya school of philosophy, but there are elements that are like that. But what is this nature? And Bhagavan Uvacha, Krishna says to him, if you practice yoga with your mind yoked in me as your basis, ashraya, a word which would later be associated with ashram. In other words, if you live in the ashram of the divine consciousness, then you will come to know him integrally, completely. So he says, I'm going to give you the essential knowledge. And he says, among thousands of men, one here and there, strives after perfection. Now, some of you have read Sri Aurobindo's Savitri, and you know that in Book 1, Canto 5, he says, one among many thousands, never touched, engrossed in the external world's design, is driven by a secret witness eye, driven by a hand of light. I think I have the quote inexactly, but it is an echo of what Krishna has said to Arjuna here on the battlefield. He goes on to describe that I've spoken to you about my eightfold nature of prakriti, but what I have besides this prakriti which you know is a higher prakriti, a para prakriti, a greater nature, which you can know only when you come into my being, Madhavam. If you rise to that higher nature, of which prakriti is the externalization, then there is the source of the jiva. Who is the jiva? But the embodiment, wrongly said, the jiva is the soul of each person who assents to incarnation here. So the soul that we know that comes from above comes from that supreme nature. It is cognate with the supreme. It is the same essence, but individuated and being born seemingly here in time from eternity. It comes with that supreme power. It comes with that flavor of eternity. This is this being which is immortal behind. He also says, this is what upholds the whole world. This is the true source behind the apparent universe. So in other words, the triple guna, sattva, rajas, tamas, is not the final deployment of nature, it's the superficial aspect of nature. There is something greater, of which we discover, in a sense, when we find the jiva within us, when we live in that which is immortal and at one with the supreme. Now, this has huge consequences. This is not exactly what we've read in the Upanishads, where the Atman is described as being one with Brahman. Because this supreme nature is not a blank, homogenized ocean of white milk, but a person. This is a great person establishing personhood in us. So personhood is not a fiction. If you come to know that supreme person, you are not dissolved a drop of water into an ocean or a drop of milk back into a vat of milk, but you are still at one with that while you are an individual. And he has also said that that is the matrix, literally the matrix of the universe. And so the individual, the universe, and the transcendent are all one there. It is here that the diversity seems to rock our world, if you will, and we lose sight of what we really are. And he says, beyond me there's nothing, Arjuna. This, I am the end of it, and on me, pearl stranded, is all of this world. I am that strand, and everything is a pearl upon it. I run through everything. At the very center of all beings is this divine. He defines himself as being the essence of all that we see in the world. The scent of the earth, the light, the energy, the heat and fire. He's pranava, the originating symbol, Om. So there's nowhere that we look that we don't find him. But attending to the world of the senses, leaning out into that world, we in a sense have lost the essence of our nature. We can reverse our consciousness and go back, rediscover what we essentially are, and live from there faultlessly in the world. He describes himself as being unrevealed to those who do not move to this knowledge. So what they get of the world is always a mask. They never see the being behind. To see the being behind requires the person to practice a greater yoga. Because even those who gain the ordinary knowledge, which we call the fruit of Buddha Yoga, don't have this vision of that. There is a greater yoga that must be done. So that leads us then into the eighth chapter. And Krishna says, what is that Brahman? Tad Brahma. What is Adhyatma, Karma, Adibhuta, Adidaiva? And so this is, again, an important lesson because this links things together. The Supreme Brahman is the Akshara. Now, this is not Krishna's declaration of what he, the unknowable Purushottama, is, that supreme person, that para-prakriti. He's describing Brahman as the akshara, that which is imperishable. So here, in this world, things move around, mutate. This is the realm of becoming. Things are formed, they come into being, They're sustained for a while and then they pass out of being. So that's the world of the kshara, the changing person. The akshara is immobile, is vast, unimpeachable, stainless. That, in later Vedantic philosophy, we'll describe as the Atman, the pure Atman. So Krishna has, in a sense, given us now an order of the world which we should look upon with a little focus, because this leads to his cosmology. The final state of realization for a yogin is not immersion into the blank akshara. He's already said, no, I am there, I am above. The Purushottama is above Brahman. Brahman is as if his conscious substance that he uses to form the world with and to sustain it. But it is not all that he is. Remember when we were looking at the Mandukya Upanishad, and there were four steps to the Om. There's a secret, a fourth, a Turiya, undescribable, beyond all. That, in a sense, is in the idea of it, that kind of perfect transcendence, above the transcendent, is this idea here. So then the Svabhava is described as being the Adhyatma, the inner self. We have just now seen an equation between the jiva, part of the Paraprakriti, part of the supreme nature, core of our individual self, has its swabhava, its own being, through which it expresses itself in the world. So this is even different than the swadharma. So there are several stages of being in this metaphysic, answerable to our deepening spiritual experience. We begin life, we're lost in the kshara bhava. We're lost in the mutable personality. We're happy, we're sad, we're hot, we're cold, etc. But behind that is a real kernel of truth in the definition of our nature, how we are in the world. Oh, not the personality defects and all of that, but there's something essential that's been missioned forth in us. And that is the flavoring, you might say, the distinct flavoring, which is unique, but comes energetically from that jiva, that essence of soul, of personhood, which is one with the divine nature, Paraprakriti, the supreme nature, which is not different from Purushottama. They are the same thing. So you see, at the essence of your very active nature is something born from the divine. So it's not to be got rid of. This is a deeper teaching still than what Arjuna was instructed to act according to his dharma. Well, his dharma is again a reflection of his swabhava. The kshara stands outside, then there's the swadharma, inside is the swabhava. The swabhava represents the jiva really comes from that. That is the supreme divine. So I hope we've successfully linked all these things so that we understand that you, in a sense, are the divine missioned forth to accomplish something. Perhaps we've forgotten that. Krishna knows what he's there for in the human body, and he's directing all things as the Purushottama above, and in a sense engineering even here within his limited physical frame some of the pertinent work so that it turns in the right direction and accomplishes his grand design. So, immediately, stand and fight. You see, he will not give this up. Knowing this does not excuse you from action. Remember, he said earlier that it isn't renunciation that gives you that knowledge. You can have that knowledge yoked to action. You can seemingly renounce the world, and your mind is still turning around all those old favorite things, all the games, all the stories you like to tell yourself. You never get rid of them simply by renouncing. Ask any sannyasi, did shaving his head and taking up the robe get rid of all of his troubles? No, he still brought them with him. He still got them inside. The inner baggage continues with you. So drop that into the fire of self-offering, into the sacrificial flame, and go with that smoke to the Supreme. So there's the thing. Always linking ourselves consciously to that. Krishna says, continually remembering me. Our consciousness should be so focused on that that if we forget it for a moment, we're drawn back. Again and again, it arises and arises and arises until, in a sense, it's always present in the background. You might think of your mother. She's in the next room. She's in the next room. I can go and see her at any time. And you visit, and you have experiences of this. But when you actually move into the room and you sit in her lap, you don't forget her anymore. The same thing is true when you sit in the lap of the divine. You don't forget anymore when you're really there. The remembrance has led you to deeper and deeper experience until the experience is unending, and that we call realization. The term bhakti comes in again. We're looking at the 22nd verse in the 8th chapter here. But that Supreme Person has to be won by a bhakti which turns to him alone, in whom all beings exist, and by whom all this world has been extended in space. Bhakti is a term at this point in its development which doesn't quite have the same connotation it will later in Bhakti Yoga, for instance. Bhajame, for instance, suggests one with whom we have a close association. It can even be used with the idea of two lovers who wrestle and play with each other. The idea is one of a kind of sharing. So it's that continual contact. And remember the context in which Arjuna is being taught here. The idea is to yoke yourself, put yourself in a state of union, yukta, with that. That, as it expresses itself in your mind, will be knowledge. As it expresses itself in your heart, will be love. As it expresses itself in your actions through your body, it will be sharing that cosmic will. You'll be, in a sense, riding on the force of that energy. I think we can move on productively now to the 9th chapter. And here he's going to give the most secret thing of all, he says, the essential knowledge, the Rajaguhyam, the king secret. He says, by me, all this universe has been extended. I have done this. And yet, all these existences are not in me. At one and the same time, all of this floats in me, but they're not in me. At one and the same time, I am in all of this, and I am not in all of this, he says. So how do you reconcile that with the reason? You cannot. What you have to do is have the experience of it. Yes, through Brahman. He says, if you compare it with the ethereal, the aerial notion of an akasha, a space, he said, this is the best way to conceive of it. If space is spread all out, and all these objects are contained in that, then you have the sense of what it is. This chair, that couch, these persons, all exist within this space. And yet, this space is not attached to them. You could take all these things out, that space would still be. And remember, this is not Einsteinian space that we're speaking about here. We're talking about the idea of the akasha in ancient Indian thought. So this is the idea that there is this vast expanse. Ether, akasha, is not nothing. It's not real emptiness. It is a being. It is an element, a countable element in this cosmology. But it is as if Brahman were the same as that. So in Brahman, all of this resides, and yet Brahman is superior to it. It is unmanifest while it supports the manifestation. And this goes back to that ah experience that we saw in the Upanishads. There's no way to explain it. You have the experience, you say, ah, I've got it, but I could never tell it. It does not convert to speech. So again, he says, all existences return to my divine nature in the lapse of the cycle, and the cycles are endless. At the beginning of the cycle, I loose them again into action. And how does he do it? He says, I press down on my own nature, on his prakriti, and looses all the multitude of existence into expression again. So this is an image which captures the essence. In other words, the world does not just happen for a meaningless reason. The world is purposely put into manifestation because the divine deliberately leans down and says, you will go out. It's as if he's taking his immeasurable being, measuring part of it out. This is yoga maya. The measurement through the practice of yoga, yoking his essence to manifestation, that he throws it all into being, all of this multitude coming out of his oneness, issued into this aerial principle. But it does not go into dissipation. It is still contained in his being. This essence of Brahman continues to hold it all. Prakriti exists working within the ocean of Brahman, all of this expressive of the Supreme Divine Will, who is above as the Supreme Person, Purushottama, but also here as this universal Brahman, impartite, and this universe very much partitioned. Everything spread out in diffusion, but not lost in that diffusion. There is differentiation, but there is no difference. He goes on to say, people don't know that I'm here. They don't know that I'm the secret core of all beings, and so they despise me. They treat this thing or that thing poorly, not recognizing that I am in that. That is me. From me, they originate. To me, they return. So, as an injunction, always adoring me, steadfast in your spiritual practice, bowing down with devotion. Those wise ones worship me, ever in a state of yoga. They're yukta, yoked to that. He describes himself then in the rest of the ninth chapter. He says, I'm the ritual action, the sacrifice, the fire-giving herb, the mantra, the butter, the flame, the very offering. All of this is him. In other words, wherever you cast your eye, that same supreme is there. Now imagine, as Arjuna is experiencing this speech, he's also experiencing it inwardly. So he has been given yogic experience after yogic experience, because Krishna is implanting in him this view. So Arjuna is being shape-shifted. He is practicing tremendous yoga just in hearing this, because he's employing it. He's integrating it into his being. So he's gone beyond the yoga of works. He's going in beyond the yoga of knowledge. He's going beyond what we understand devotion to be. And we're getting the sense that what is crucial to Krishna is that we live in a state of oneness with the divine. That is it. Get into that state of unification. Yeah. And he says, if you do this, then spontaneously, all good things come to you. Of course, if you live in that state of beatitude, all things are good to you. It doesn't matter whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. Everything that comes is welcome. You take it. If it's bitter, you take it. If it's sweet, you eat it. But Krishna goes on to say, but even if you don't know me, even if you don't come to know me, really, I am there behind all things. So if you offer to another, if you have a devotion to a lower form of God, know that I am behind that also. Really, what you give really comes to that. It eventually comes back to me. But to do it consciously, to do it because you have become wise by deepening your experience of me, is even better. So, who offers to me with devotion a flower, a fruit, a cup of water, that offering of love from the aspiring soul is acceptable to me. Contrast this with the Vedic ritual, where the person who wants to undertake a sacrifice has to spend great wealth to be able to do it, because it is expensive. You've got to pay all those priests. There are, what, four or five priests that are going to be lined up there. The sacrificial animal, the sacrificial fruits, the sacrificial whatever. All those things are going over there. For Krishna, he says, it isn't that. It's about your remembrance. If you do something remembering me and make it an offering to me, I receive that. I'm right there. You don't have to go anywhere. The Vedi is not this brick altar over here. The Vedi is in your heart. Come to that. Who is that fire dancing there on that Vedi? It is me. It is Krishna. It is the Purushottama. Step into that fire. Become one with me. And so, equal in all things, come to me, be liberated. And this is open to everybody. Listen to the universality of this invitation. Those who take refuge with me, O Partha, the outcasts, born from a womb of sin, women, Vaishyas, Shudras, they also attain to the highest goal. So, you who have come into this transient and unhappy world, turn to me with love, is his message. Become my minded, my lover and adorer. My minded means unified in consciousness with that. My lover and adorer, there's the heart. So both heart and mind. A sacrificer to me. So even your works are conjoined. So there's every part of your being. The affective, the intelligent, the dynamic, every aspect of your being. United with the self, you will come to me, he says, having me as your supreme goal. So then in the 10th chapter, which we go to next, he says, listen to my supreme world, Paramam Vach. Nobody really knows me, is that. But whoever knows in its right principles the elements that come into manifestation follow an inner guidance, an inner law. If you know those right principles as they come out of that oneness of the Supreme, then you come to understand the pervading lordship of the Supreme as he establishes this world. And in that state of yoga, you will come to him. So if you follow back, put it into reverse. Take the great confusion of this world, boil it down into the essential principles governing it. You can follow that back essentially. Eventually, you arrive back at the Supreme itself, himself, herself. I'll read the 9th verse. Their consciousness full of me, their life wholly given up to me, illuminating each other, mutually talking about me. They are ever contented and joyful. And here, I think, is the supreme word to these who are thus in a constant union with me. And there we go. A constant union, really, in every part of the being. Those who adore me with an intense delight of love, I give the yoga of understanding by which they come to me. So here is the fusion of knowledge and works and love insisted upon. This is the core teaching of the Gita. Nothing gets thrown away except ignorance. Nothing gets thrown away except division. And if there was no division between the armies of the Pandavas and the Kauravas, there wouldn't be this war. If there was really a sense of unity, if everybody lived as if they knew this is real, that the divine is everywhere, then this wouldn't happen. But Arjuna, because he sees that there is this ignorance and this division on the other side, still has to undertake action, though his heart and mind are in unity with the very opponent that he has to slay. undertake that action. He still has to do it because it is the right thing to do. Because you can't let ignorance overwhelm you passively. You cannot just let it go because you see a greater truth. There is a truth in action too. And so Arjuna gets called back to that again and again. Yes, live in unity with me. Still, we have to act. It is sad. It is poignant to have to destroy your teachers, your kinsmen, your grandfather. Yet, we have to do it. So then, Arjuna says to state his recognition of things. You are the Supreme Brahman, the abode, the Supreme Purusha, the original, the unborn, the all-pervading Lord. He says, can you show me yourself? Can I see what you are like? And in that way, have a glimpse of your universal form. I want to get a picture of that universal form. Just a moment, I'll be back. I'll just step through here. I know you'll recognize this from before. This is part of what will be described here in the Gita in a moment, where he says, after being given a divine eye, divyam, by Krishna, Arjuna is permitted to see him in his greater form. So he no longer sees Krishna, the man standing before him. That form melts away, and now his vision is unmasked. It's as if he had blinders on all this time. Now his consciousness expands. And let's see, we'll show them as well. You can pass this around while I'm talking if you like, if you didn't see it earlier. He's described in the 11th chapter now. We'll go straight there. I see all the gods in your body, different companies of beings. What he sees is all the sages in the firmament, the gods doing their ordained functions, and the whole world being compelled to act according to the inner dictate of the divine, moving almost in panic for fear because they're seeing this great one pursuing them. The gods, mighty as they are, feel the breath of Brahman behind them. So they keep doing what they're meant to be doing all the way. You see also the jaws of this great being, and rushing into the jaws are the opposing armies. Arjuna's enemies are getting crushed in the teeth. His friends are going in. Everything is headed into this, and the vision is stupendous, and Arjuna is shaking. He's literally trembling. This greatest of warriors has now seen something which Rudolf Alto would have called a numinous experience, where you see the majesty, the awesomeness of God. He is not in a state of identification with Krishna at this point. He is a witness, and it's overwhelming. It's when the infinite overwhelms the finite, and you are thunderstruck. This is a kind of spiritual experience too. The mystical is where you move into merger with the divine. But the numinous experience is one where you are staggered by the enormity of the divine. And this is what Krishna has shown him here. You see, the sun is his right eye, the moon is his left eye. And all the world is in him. It is an unendurable experience. One cannot have that for long unless you've been trained for it, unless you've made the adhara strong. His adhara has been made to function as a warrior. He's ready for battle. This would demand a different kind of tapasya from him. For this he is not ready. So he asks Krishna, please, I can't bear any more. Will you please restore yourself? May I see you in your four-armed form again? Now that is interesting because Krishna the human has two arms. But he's asked to, so obviously he has already been granted an increased vision. Now he can see Krishna in his inner nature, at least some of his inner nature, to know that there are many powers beyond the human which are present in Krishna. Even if he does not regard the entirety of the universal experience, he knows that that denotation is there. That significant form that is Krishna's has something behind. He has become aware of it. So he's not lost in the gross design of nature anymore. He doesn't just see the fleshly form of Krishna. He sees the inner being of Krishna as well. The sukshma sharira, the subtle physical, has become apparent to him. So, then he says, who he is chief among? Who are his main vibhutis? And he says, earlier chapter. an error, I apologize. He has already described earlier who he is chief among, and by the way, while he says he is Vishnu among the Adityas, he says he is also Shiva among the Rudras. So the idea that Krishna is exclusively identified with Vishnu is apparently not so in the Bhagavad Gita. It will later become so. But in this age, he is not exclusive to the Vaishnava path. In fact, as he describes himself, he is supreme over all paths and possible forms of the divine, but standing as the best in all. So, having lapsed from that, let's move forward into the last chapter for us tonight, the 12th. And he says, those who find their mind completely absorbed in me and in that state of constant union, possessed of a supreme faith. So again, the conscious communion, a union throughout the being, a being that is composed of faith, surety that the divine's will be worked out. He says, that is the one who is most perfectly in union with me. That is the best among the yogis. So those who give up all their actions into me, And there we go. We're back to the sacrificial fire, right? Because for us, the whole world is the sacrificial altar. With our minds worshiping or meditating on that unswervingly, if we fix, that is yukta, again, the state of communion with that, then in that we are launched into an existence above the mortal, and we are no longer death-bound. That is the state of immortality. It isn't a question of whether the body dies or not. It's what happens to the immortal being. In earlier ages, immortality might have been the idea of, can I be taken bodily to heaven? How do I know that I will live beyond this life? For Krishna, this is an absurdity only pronounceable because we have forgotten who we are, because always we are. The question is, can you yoke every part of your being back to me? And if you can do that, then you will come to the highest good. And if you can't, then practice Abhyasa Yoga, the yoga of practice. Train yourself. Do it gradually. Every step that you take towards me is a real step, and it counts. And this transition to a divine consciousness, this transition to a divine consciousness will eventually have its fruit. You will arrive. Keep working. So, putting desires behind. Don't pursue the pleasant. Don't recoil from the unpleasant. Be equal to friend and enemy. He said, that man who can do this is dear to me. That's the one who lives in my nature. But exceedingly dear to me are those who make me, Purushottama, he means, their one supreme aim, and follow with a perfect faith and an immortalizing dharma what I'm teaching. So this is the greater teaching. This is the greater yoga. So it's one which encompasses every part of our nature, that we should be conscious of that in our feeling, conscious of that in our mentation, in our cognition, and conscious of that in our hands and our feet when we walk and do. To be totally consumed in that divine fire destroys the ignorance of dark division and establishes us in communion with that. So that's it for the 12th chapter tonight. I think we did it in just about an hour. So I don't know if you have any questions. I'd be glad to take them.